Hello there. Today is Thursday, September 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, two major natural disasters have paralyzed parts of the Caribbean and Mexico.
A lot of Puerto Rico is submerged right now, unfortunately.
Republicans ramp up their latest effort to repeal and replace President Obama's health care law. Also ahead, reviews of the latest movies to hit U.S. theaters. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the strongest hurricane to hit Puerto Rico in almost 90 years has knocked out power across the entire island of 3.4 million people. Hurricane Maria, with maximum sustained winds of more than 200 kilometers per hour, has destroyed hundreds of homes and caused heavy flooding after making landfall Wednesday. There have been reports of widespread flooding, with many streets being turned into rivers, and forecasters say it could re-intensify. Joining me now is meteorologist Brian Hurley with the National Weather Prediction Center. Brian, before we talk about where this is headed, tell us first what has happened.
Maria made landfall this week in Puerto Rico as a Category 4 system. The effects have been widespread with the surge. I'm not too privy on how much of the surge they've got, but certainly tremendous amount of wind damage, especially around that eye. San Juan was on the eastern and northeastern portion of the eye, so they were affected quite a bit with high winds, massive power outages.
They're 100% without power, and I've even heard somebody say something to the fact that they will never fully recover from this. I mean, how bad is the damage as far as you can tell or you know, or what kind of a damage this level of a storm will do?
For us in our lifetime, probably it's unprecedented, certainly. Again, going back 85 years, and given the infrastructure that we have now with the power lines and whatnot, I did hear that, you know, we've got a water issue as well for fresh water. So that's another thing. Tremendous amount of rainfall. And, you know, they have some mountains in Puerto Rico, and that's actually exacerbating the flooding threat because of all that runoff and the mudslides that are occurring. We did hear right now unconfirmed reports of up to 30 inches of rain in some areas. 30 inches. Now, remember
that's
what happened in Texas with Harvey. It took a few days to get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so these 30 inches probably fallen a little sooner than Texas got there. So that's not helping with the flooding situation. A lot of Puerto Rico is submerged right now, unfortunately. Even if it's a little bit, you know, those higher, certainly the higher ground wouldn't be. But San Juan in particular has widespread flooding around the city.
What about the U.S. Virgin Islands? Did they also get hit hard again after they've just, they were all people from there had been taking refuge in Puerto Rico?
St. Croix did, perhaps a direct hit in terms of the eye, but they were part of that eye wall,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe not the eye exactly going right over.
It's gone from there now. Where is Maria, and is she still a big storm?
Right, she is. Right now, technically, I mean, if you look at a satellite picture, it's kind of in between Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic. At the 8 o'clock advisory, the center was 55 miles or 90 kilometers east-northeast of Punta Cana in the Dominican Republic. Now, the maximum sustained winds, it had gone down. It had gone down, I believe, at one point to a Cat 1 or a low Cat 2, but it's now up to 110 miles an hour going over that open water.
Mm.
And having the eye take on typical characteristic. It looked like it was pretty ragged going over Puerto Rico. So 110 miles an hour is the top end of a Category 2 hurricane. And its motion is still to the northwest.
What about the U.S. mainland? Are we still waiting to see where it's going to go?
No, we are. You know, you can never say never, right? And because Jose is well to the north, and Jose is a tropical storm right now, weakening as it is, but it's the confidence is higher and higher with each passing day that Maria, like Jose, will stay off the U.S. coast. Now, we still have to watch out for the northern mid-Atlantic and the northeast with Maria. We'll see. But the confidence, you look at their cone of uncertainty on the National Hurricane Center site, and even the farthest left is just offshore, taking us into day five. Starting to breathe a little more comfortably. but it's still something to watch, though. Everybody from the mid-Atlantic, northern mid-Atlantic especially, let's say the Delmarva northward, Jersey, and into New England, especially New England, Massachusetts, Cape Cod. Keep an eye on this one.
All right, meteorologist Brian Hurley with the Weather Prediction Center. Thanks so much. Well, rescue workers continue their searches in hopes of finding survivors of a magnitude 7.1 earthquake that collapsed dozens of buildings in and around Mexico City. Civilians joined the search and rescue teams shortly after the quake struck Tuesday, using heavy machinery and their bare hands to remove piles of rubble. Officials say they'll continue working until they exhaust all possibilities of finding people alive. VOA's Sarah Williams talks to Mexico-based journalist James Bleers for an update on the ground there.
The damage is massive. Just in Mexico City alone, the mayor of Mexico City, Miguel Ángel Mancera, has said that 44 buildings have collapsed. Probably more will have to be demolished. The rescue efforts are concentrated at the moment at a children's school, Enrique Rebesmen, in the south of the city. More than 20 children are confirmed dead. In fact, we think 32. Five adults have died. There are more children under the rubble, but the structural damage is immense, not just to Mexico City. The epicenter was in Puebla, a church there, a church service going on at the time of the quake, and major loss of life there. Also, a major loss of life and massive structural damage to the state of Morelos, which is just to the south of Mexico and the state of Mexico. That's been reported by the governor of Morelos, Graco Ramirez. Damage and loss of life as far away as Guerrero, which is right in the south. This earthquake, two things that make it even more distinctive than it already is and more tragic than it already is. On the 7th of September, we had an earthquake prior to this, which was even more powerful. But this one originated on land, not at sea, off the Pacific. This one originated on land and has been far more devastating. This happened yesterday, the 19th of September. The 19th of September was exactly 32 years since a massive earthquake hit Mexico City, devastating the downtown area, concertinaing many, many buildings, and the loss of life there at that time was conservatively estimated at more than 10,000 people. People here can hardly believe that 32 years to the day of that earthquake, another one has devastated Mexico City.
Well, considering that previous earthquake, were there changes, revisions made to the buildings in the city as far to make them more earthquake-proof?
Yes, exactly. What has happened is that many buildings here, taller buildings, have to have steel inner structures, and the design has been altered so that in quakes like this, many of the buildings sway instead of snap or crumble. But this has not worked this particular time with some of the buildings. A number of these particular buildings which have collapsed, not all of them, but a number of them were older buildings. Of course, these stringent regulations don't apply so much as you get outside Mexico City. And the damage to, as I've mentioned, to Morelos, Puebla, and the state of Mexico has been considerably worse than probably expected because these building regulations probably weren't enforced as strictly as in Mexico City. This is a major, major disaster, major tragedy. President Enrique Peña Nieto, the president of Mexico, has declared 3 days of national mourning. This is not over yet. There are many people still trapped in buildings. There's a building near a place called Linda Vista in the north of Mexico City. Apparently, the rescue services say that six, possibly seven people are trapped inside a luxury apartment block, which was six floors. It's now crumpled into about two and a half. And they feel and they think they've heard voices, and they think that people are alive still in there. But very few people are going to work today. Schools in, I think it's 10 states, fanning out from Mexico City, have cancelled all lessons. And the concentration, the attention of people is on this rescue effort to see, because time is running out. 20 hours or more have gone and passed since the earthquake. As the interior minister said, the longer it goes, the less chance there is.
All right. Well, Mike Corey is a Canadian travel blogger in Mexico City, and he says the aftershocks are continuing. He's on high alert if there has to be an evacuation.
There's been about 40 aftershocks in the middle of the night, all very, very small ones. So they have been happening. But again, I don't know what to expect. I don't really know. I mean, we have backpacks lined up by the door. That was part of going to bed last night, putting everything lined up by the door, because yesterday it just caught us off guard. Like, ran outside, no shoes, no phone, no keys. So we have all that ready to go in case anything happens. We can just grab the bag and get out. Because once you're in the street, you're fine, especially around this part where there's not that many giant towering buildings.
Well, at least 230 people are confirmed dead, but that number, unfortunately, is expected to rise. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump says he's decided whether the U.S. should stay in the Iran nuclear deal. Counselor Mueller is seeking records of Trump's actions as president. The U.S. wheat production is the lowest in recorded history. And unveiling a new Libya plan, the U.S. sees opportunities for peace. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The U.S. Senate is set next week to vote again, or to start debating overhauling the country's health care policies, a last-ditch effort by Republicans to dismantle the signature law championed by former Democratic President Barack Obama. A spokeswoman for Republican leader Mitch McConnell said Wednesday that senators would consider their party's latest legislative proposal to overturn the Affordable Care Act, popularly known as Obamacare, just days ahead of a deadline as dictated by the Senate's legislative rules for completing action. Well, numerous Democratic critics, along with several major health care groups in the country, say that over the coming years, the change in the law would cut millions of people from the insurance rolls. Joining me now to discuss is Len Nichols, director for the Center for Health Policy Research and Ethics at George Mason University. So what do you think about this latest attempt?
Well, I think it's in some ways a last gasp of people who feel like they're afraid to go into the primaries, having failed to have repealed Obamacare. Remember, they've been saying they're going to repeal Obamacare ever since Obamacare passed. And then when they got to Congress, they said, we'll do it as soon as you give us a president. And so now we have Trump. And so they're embarrassed that they failed. And the substance of the matter is far from the point. The point is the politics of it, and that's the way they're selling it to their members. Look, we know this bill doesn't make any sense, but we have to get it passed to avoid a wholesale challenge in the primaries.
You're saying they know it doesn't make any sense, or are you saying it doesn't make any sense, and if so, why?
Well, I was reading some serious reporter who tried to get, I think, 9 different Republicans to explain the substance of the bill. They don't know it. Cassidy doesn't know it as well as Jimmy Kimmel does, and so you're there, and he's clearly trying to sell it with false numbers. I mean, they're just not telling the truth about it, and no one reads the details except the wonks, and the policy wonks uniformly say this is not a good bill. The serious people who think about health care, people who really understand what health care means and does, have said this bill is not a good one.
And why would that? Why? Why do they say it is not a good bill?
Well, the fundamental thing the bill does is reduce the amount of subsidies to enable people to buy health insurance they can't otherwise afford. And that's fact one. And it's a big, big cut. The second thing the bill does is it takes away protections that are in current insurance market rules so that states would be allowed, if they wanted to, and some of them surely would, to allow insurers to charge more for those who have pre-existing conditions, to allow insurers to go back to the world where we had annual limits and lifetime limits and different kinds of restrictions on coverages, and it moves money from states that did expand Medicaid to states that didn't expand Medicaid, and then at the end of the horizon, cuts spending for everybody. So it is a retraction of the commitment to enable people to get covered. It is a denial of the protection of people with pre-existing conditions, and it is a fundamentally dishonest approach to this whole thing. And then the goal of it is to reduce spending in the long run, which it does by uncovering 20 to 30 million people.
So when you say uncovering, are you saying that 20 to 30 million people could potentially not have health insurance anymore?
Absolutely. Once you take away those subsidies and you allow insurers to charge people more who have pre-existing conditions, then people won't be able to afford health care. Almost all the people who gained coverage through the Affordable Care Act got coverage because the Affordable Care Act made it far more affordable for them. And this bill would reverse that. And by 2026, it would reverse it completely. But the point is, there's a way to rationalize ways to fix the markets and make the whole thing work. And the same thing all policy wonks have been saying all along. You can fix what's wrong with the ACA without blowing it up. But that's not what the Republican leadership feels like they have promised their base, and they're afraid of their base.
Are you, as a healthcare expert, a healthcare economist, are you concerned about this bill?
I'm very concerned about the fact that we have push this to the point where insurers are reluctant to participate in the marketplace in 2018 because they don't know what the rules are going to be, and they don't know what the commitment is going to be to coverage beyond 2018. The fact that they're throwing this thing together at the last minute to try to get it over the finish line is frankly an insult to the men and women who work really hard to make policy choices clear to the members of Congress. That's what staff is for. And essentially, this apparatus has been neutralized by keeping this bill behind closed doors and trying to rush it to a vote without a CBO score and proper hearings. I mean, you go back to McCain talking about regular order. What that really means is for committees like the Finance Committee to not have a one-day hearing where they only allow senators who support the bill to testify, but where they have days and weeks of hearings where they get all kinds of people from all kinds of perspectives, including stakeholders in the system, who, by the way, are pretty much unanimously opposed to this bill, as they were to all the others. The bills that they put together are not well thought out, and they're going to cause a great deal of harm. And right now, they're causing unnecessary uncertainty, and that, too, is causing harm because it's going to ultimately raise premiums and pull people out of the market, and therefore more people will be unable to afford health care. All this is completely avoidable, but it requires the Republican leadership to admit that what they've been doing about Obamacare for a long time is basically a lie. They basically have been saying this bill is a disaster. It's not a disaster. It wasn't perfect. It needs to be fixed. And until they are willing to admit that, they feel trapped to a train that says we have to repeal or we will lose in our primaries. And that's where we are. We are literally putting more stock in keeping a so-called promise than into analysis of whether this bill improves the health care of our country or not.
All right, Len Nichols, Director for the Center for Health Policy Research and Ethics at George Mason University. Thank you so much. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA. VOA.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa news. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now as we turn to what's trending on social media. And for that, we're joined by Andrew Palchevsky. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, a topic that we've talked about consistently is Russia's interference in the U.S. presidential election in 2016 and mm-hmm. how they've used social media to try to influence the vote.
Yes.
Well, there's a story today about the same exact kind of thing happening in Germany. They're set to vote this Sunday in their parliamentary elections, but it's not coming from Russia.
Really?
According to German researchers, they found that there is influence happening on social media, trying to influence the German election, coming from Americans.
What?
Apparently, they found instances where members of the so-called alt-right in the United States have tried to influence the German election using things like YouTube, Reddit, other websites, social networks. They are using a lot of these tactics to try to push people for or against one of the parties there in Germany. Very interesting that this is originating from the U.S. and not from Russia.
Mm-hmm,
as we've talked about, Russia seems to be the culprit in a lot of these cyber instances, but this is coming from the U.S. Now, it's not coming from the U.S. government.
Right, it's I was just going to say, it's not the government, like the Russian influence in our election was definitely
and that's the
government.
Big difference, is that the Russian influence was coming from the Russian government. This is coming from just individuals. But the fact that we see individuals trying to influence this election shows how interconnected the world is on social media and shows what an impact people can have on social media. It doesn't have to be a concerted effort from a government. It can be just individuals.
The internet has opened us up to so many good things, but it also has definitely created some problems.
It has, which brings us to our next trending story.
Oh.
Wednesday at the United Nations, social media got perhaps the largest world stage and attention on the world stage that it ever has. The leaders of France, Italy, and the United Kingdom met on Wednesday with representatives from Facebook, Google, and Microsoft to talk about extremist content online.
Oh,
and British Prime Minister Theresa May has a request for those companies. She wants them to remove extremist content 1 to 2 hours after it's been posted. Now, for some context, the current window is about 24 hours. They'd like Facebook, Twitter, Google, you name it, to take off this extremist content, remove it from the internet within a 24-hour period. Well, now they want to get that down to just a couple of hours. This has become a bit of a problem for social networks. They said that it's near impossible to track some of this stuff down, that it takes more than an hour or two, that they can't necessarily be held liable if they can't catch it that quickly. But this is part of that escalating debate that we're seeing with social media companies and governments. Governments want them to police the content. Social media companies want resources to do that, or at least they don't want to be punished for that content.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective as always, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. And turning now to the latest movies in U.S. theaters, we're joined by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Hey, Jeff, so let's start off with the new docudrama Strong about the bombing in Boston at the Marathon. Wow, looks very intense.
You know, Jake Gyllenhaal is one of our greatest actors of our generation, and he always accepts movies that has challenging roles, emotional roles. I mean, he never delivers a performance that's subpar or forgettable. I mean, and this is no exception. He plays Jeff Bauman, who loses both of his legs when two bombs explode in the Boston Marathon, April 15, 2013? He was right there. He was next to the bombs. He got a good look at the terrorist that left the knapsack with the bomb. So after his legs are blown off and he's taken to the hospital and he's unconscious for a good, you know, they had to amputate his legs from the knee up. Can you imagine that? This 20-something-year-old kid. Mm. And when he wakes up, and of course he can't talk, he's intubated, he gets a piece of paper and says, I want to write something, you know, emotions to it. He goes, I saw the terrorist. So because of him, they had a description of what to look for on the video and find him and a patriot, all the way. And that's exactly what happened, how they captured these guys and they found them is because of his eyewitness. So the movie, of course, is about so much emotion with Jeffman. He's considered a hero. He's got all his attention. He's trying to deal with the loss of his legs. He's trying to deal with his family, trying to deal with his instant fame. He's being, from Oprah Winfrey to everyone wants to request an interview with him. He's being held up as a national hero. He's being honored at the hockey games, at all these different, he's got so much attention on him, and he doesn't consider himself a hero, of course. And then, of course, he goes through all the struggles of losing his legs, you know, the drug abuse, you know, the pushing away from his family and just the suicidal thoughts. I mean, so this movie is just loaded with all kinds of emotion, all kinds of imagery, and it's a real powerful film. Now, does it become formulaic? Yeah, it does, because you're sitting here thinking to yourself, well, you know, someone's going to go through all of this. But you got to remember this actually happened, and Jake Gyllenhaal is just absolutely amazing in this performance. And I think it's going to be one of the most talked about films in the fall.
Is this based on a true story, or it is a true story?
It is a true story, yeah. Jeff Bauman, he lost both of his legs when the bombs exploded. Mm-hmm. He was the one who identified the terrorist. So this is a true story. It absolutely is. So it goes to the whole gambit of emotions, the whole gambit of all the things that he was struggling with. It's a really powerful film. I think people are going to walk away thinking, of course he's a hero, but he just suffered so much. And he was dealing with so many different things. You just can't imagine what he's going through. I mean, there are times where I had to look away from the screen. I couldn't see. It was just so shocking.
Bring the Kleenex. And then we've got Kingsman: The Golden Circle. Now, I looked a little bit at this one, watched the trailer.
This is a sequel, yes, and it's pretty much a takeoff on James Bond, and it's an action adventure, and it's a comedy from director Matthew Vaughn. And what it is, the Kingsmen are a Secret Service agency that has been around for many, many years. They're not known to the general public, and they're the English Secret Service, so much to say. And it stars Taron Egerton as Eggsy, who's this secret agent. And they're trying to stop this time around Julianne Moore, who's the world's most successful drug dealer. She makes $250 billion a year, and she's stuck somewhere in Cambodia in the jungle, and no one knows about her, and she doesn't like that. So she's going to distribute this through her drugs, this virus that's going to turn people blue and kill them unless you get to deal with the president of the United States. So, of course, the Kingsmen, and we saw in the first movie, their secret headquarters is blown up. So now only a few of the surviving agents go over to America, and our version of the Kingsmen are called the Statesmen. And we have Channing Tatum, and we have it run by Jeff Bridges. So it's all done in Texas and through Kentucky, and all done through whiskey, you know, as a front, manufacturing whiskey. So we have a definite American flair meets English in this comedy. It's rated R for a reason. There's some graphic violence in it. There's some foul language, and there's some adult situation. Incredible action sequences. Just remember, this is a comic book action film, and it's a lot of fun. I thought it was a great time. I really had a great time with it.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Working with their partners in the global coalition to defeat ISIS, Iraq's security forces have made significant progress in the mission to liberate all of the territory ISIS once held in Iraq. Speaking recently in Erbil, Iraq, Special Presidential Envoy for the coalition, Brett McGurk, called the historic cooperation between the Iraqi security forces and the Kurdish Peshmerga essential to the recent victories against ISIS, also known as Daesh. Mr. McGurk took note of the cost of the fight on our heroic partners who have sacrificed so much in this fight. The Peshmerga have suffered almost 2,000 martyrs in this overall campaign, and the Iraqi forces have probably suffered 5 times more, he said. The sacrifice from the Kurdish Peshmerga is something that we, the United States and the entire world, really honor. We extend our condolences to the martyrs and to the families, and similar condolences to all those lost on the side of Iraqi security forces. Special Envoy McGurk emphasized that the battle against ISIS is not over and pointed to the upcoming fight in the northern city of Hawija, where it is estimated that some hundreds of ISIS fighters remain in control of the city. He urged continued cooperation between the Peshmerga and the Iraqi security forces so that ISIS's hold on Hawija is rooted out in a smart way. Mr. McGurk noted the political disagreements between the Kurdish leaders and the government in Baghdad, including over a proposed independence referendum later this month by the Kurdish regional government. The United States does not support the referendum. In a press statement, the White House said, "Holding the referendum in disputed areas is particularly provocative and destabilizing. We therefore call on the Kurdistan Regional Government to call off the referendum and enter into serious and sustained dialogue with Baghdad, which the United States has repeatedly indicated it is prepared to facilitate." The White House noted that the referendum is distracting from the efforts to defeat ISIS and stabilize the liberated areas. Special Envoy McGurk pointed out that the Iraqi security forces and the Peshmerga have fought as brothers against their common enemy. It's very important that we remain united and focused on the efforts to defeat Daesh and ensure that they have a lasting defeat. This war is not over, and that's a critical message for everybody.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.